My true fellows and sweet maid, Grosvenor has said Tomas must go. I know it is for the best because the people of Dalston are very wary of me. Grosvenor says they will burn my old farm down, and that except for him, all the village despises me. At least that is his view. It is good to know that all will change, and there are true men to follow, like Ken and Peter. Though 400 years is a long time, and there is much to happen to mankind. It is sad that men must learn righteousness from their ugly ways, believing that they have to look for truth in ruthlessness, and never follow a path that is for truth. I pray for my fellows at night that they are never imprisoned because of their love for their brother Tomas. Are we not true men? I say, woe to all you men who are not true, for you are marked by God. He will not have your company, but you will walk with the beasts of Tartarus forevermore. Yes, you who have no worth in this life. I know that I mustn't sorrow, for I cannot put these feelings to paper. But you must know that I weep and am emotional. I find it hard to write. Perhaps you will come to Oxford. Now I think there is no danger for me there, for I hear the king is very sick and all is quiet in the church. I shall go by boat from Chester to Bristol. There I will buy a horse, for mine will not go on a boat. It is as scared of water as it is scared of the Fives. I also weep for him. I shall try to make my stay at Brassnose, though I know I was expelled many years ago. I will write my book about my brothers and maid, and of the end of Lucas and the little puppy and our love for each other. One day you will all sit down at my table for wine and meat by the river in Oxford, where we shall read each other's books and laugh, and we shall speak of truth and good men, watching Oxford change together forevermore. In your time my book is old, but I shall not go to my God until it is written, and then we will all be truly embraced. My love to you all. I shall await you in Oxford. Tomas Harden. And then the last communication. Ken, Deb, Peter, true are the nightmares of those that fear. What you fear will be your reality if you let it. Believe in yourself. Safe are the bodies of the silent world. As long as your kind cannot penetrate our world, we are safe. Turn, pretty flower, towards the sun, for you shall grow and sow, but the flower reaches too high and withers in the burning light. Knowledge will be your progress, but your kind are coming close to getting their fingers burnt. Indirectly, you may prevent this. Get out your bricks. Get ready to build. Write the book. Pussycat, Pussycat went to London to seek fame and fortune. The cat went to visit the queen, but instead frightened a little mouse under the chair. Ultimately, London will be a significant place. Stick to your main aims. It doesn't matter how hard they seem to get. Do not be distracted by that tiny mouse that has a deceiving charm. Faith must not be lost. You all rely on each other's faith. There is another person to come. They will be the help we need. You will know them when they come. Tomas did eventually write his book and soon died shortly afterward. He placed it in a secure place. It shouldn't take too many years to find it, though he wrote in Latin with the help of a friend that he met in Oxford. The inscription reads, "He writes this in the hope that mine fellows will one day find this book. Then may our lands be not so distant. We will finish. Now you have a lot of work to do. There is no need for you to write back, as we will have gone. Thank you for your cooperation. 2109.
Ghosties, my ghoulies, and my moth people, welcome back to Noctivagant, the show about the strange, paranormal, otherworldly, and the people who write books about it. My name is Nick, and I am joined by the temporally displaced duo, Jay and Rory Wicks.
Where'd I go?
I'm going to shove 2109 in the locker.
On this show, we are going to discuss, dissect, and review the best and worst of the world of paranormal and conspiracy literature. So settle in, buckle up, and prepare for a walk on the midnight roads of Noctivagant.
Thank you.
glad we're back, and I can't get the image out of my head of just Jay just violently kicking like a gray into a locker and just slamming it shut on its head over and over again.
Get real, nerd.
You know, for someone as physically small as you are, Jay,
yeah,
like I could see a lot of violence in you.
It's the small ones you got to worry about.
Yeah, they're like firecrackers. Yeah, they're going to take a finger when they go off.
That means two things.
Oh, I get it. No, I don't.
You're both going in the locker.
Good luck fitting me. I'm just saying, I never, even though I was a fucking nerd in high school, I never had to worry about that because I was physically too large for the lockers. Fat was my defense mechanism.
I mean, it does work as both padding and a discretionary tool for the physical violence.
Well, and now I'm at the point where, like, you know, my hair was going, so I buzzed it, and I got the big beard. I look much meaner than I am.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so now I got a lot going for me in terms of, like, visual street cred.
Yeah, it helps, though, that when you smile, you look like a dork.
My high school lockers were too narrow for any like living person to fit inside, but I could fit inside my middle school lockers, and I would just put myself in them.
That is a solution.
You know, I could see it. You were your own worst bully.
You know what? It was quiet in there, and so during passing time, I would just be. I'm gonna stay in here until. Until it's quiet.
I'm just imagining, like, walking to my next class and ahead of me seeing a locker swing open and seeing you, like, disentangle yourself out from it like you were merging from the shadow realm.
Yeah, and then I'd just go to class.
The only thing I ever used my locker for was to stash drugs. And nobody's surprised.
Yeah, I barely used mine because I just kept everything in my backpack. And one time I remember... I left my locker for like 3 months and I didn't open it. And I apparently had left food in there.
Oh, no.
Jesus Christ.
And
Nick.
I opened it up to find like one of those, you know, lunchbox coolers in there. And I immediately knew something had gone wrong. I didn't even open it. I took the whole thing and put it in the trash.
That's what you do.
Yeah, no, I knew there was something unholy inside of it. Feel like I heard it screaming for help as I dropped it into the trash can.
No, that's just when you throw away the whole locker.
And that entity's soul. Became the poltergeist in the vertical plane.
And we've come full circle.
Oh, God. It turns out my fucking moldy bologna sandwich, that is 2109. Oh, God. I can see Rory suppressing a gag over on the other side of the room as they're trying to swallow their donut.
I was eating a delicious donut, and you had to talk about mold entities, and I have a weak stomach, as we know.
See, me putting 2109 into a locker is not mean. I am returning them to their place of origin.
I see.
Like
yes.
The salmon.
Get back in there and continue to fester.
Like the salmon swimming back to the streams of their birth.
Just like the salmon, it's actively rotting as it does it.
All right, so what are we talking about today?
We are here for the second part and the conclusion of The Vertical Plane by Ken Webster. So for those who, you know, may have forgotten last episode, we've been talking through the story of Ken and Debbie Webster as they have been engaged in what appears to be cross-temporal communications via an early BBC microcomputer, where they are speaking with a man known only as Lucas Wainman, who existed at some point in the distant past and is communicating with them via some unnatural apparatus he called a Leems. And recently, it seems that another entity has entered the fold, 2109, which claims to be some sort of maybe future entity, maybe extra-dimensional entity, who seems to have some sort of power over these communications.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very weird story, so much so that that summary was really inadequate. So go back and listen to the first episode if you're just coming in here fresh.
Yeah. You should definitely listen to part one before part two. That is how it works, typically speaking.
That's how parts work.
Yeah. Typically speaking, yeah.
Yeah, it's why, you know, I saw Breaking Dawn part two and I didn't understand what's happening, but I knew I hated it.
Yeah, that's all you needed to know is that you hated it. So.
Yeah.
And if you like this and you want to participate in, you know, in ways or read the book ahead of time for the next one, next month, our book is going to be Northern Lights, High Strangeness in Sweden.
Yep, by Fred Anderson.
Yeah, and that's going to be an adventure that we will go on together.
And I think it's that. We're going to be doing that in December, wintry months. We're going to frozen Sweden.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Even though most of the stories in the book take place in summer, but we'll pretend.
We We're good at that. Professional pretenders, some might say.
I'm trying to say that. It makes me feel like my whole life is a lie.
You have a creative writing degree.
Oh, God, I'm the problem.
And we roleplay.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, so are we ready to launch into part two?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, here we go with the conclusion of A Vertical Plane. Part 4, The God of the Machine. In the ensuing weeks, the SPR conducted more fruitless experiments, with the only partial success being a message that arrived moments after the SPR investigators had left the cottage, which John Bucknall presumably declared simply left too much room for fraud to be believed. Though their fixation on 2109 endured, and they repeatedly asked Ken to send messages on their behalf. And 2109 seemed happy to play along, but for Ken, 2109 remained an unwelcome intrusion into his budding friendship with Lucas. Quote, the argument ran like this. Lucas fitted into a relatively comprehensible worldview, a man who, through his words, their clarity, and apparent authenticity, threw light into our darkness as we struggled to make sense of this seemingly impossible communication. I could stand by him, but 2109, they couldn't even spell. However, just because they presented more problems did not entitle me to neglect or ignore them. 2109 didn't help matters either, continually stringing all involved along with teases of forbidden knowledge. When Dave Welch sent a number of questions about the nature of the universe, 2109 responded to his inquiries with a parable about the dangers of knowledge. If a man eats a bad fruit and dies, did the fruit kill him, or the knowledge that it could be eaten? Knowledge of the truths behind the phenomenon, 2109 seemed to imply, would be a poison all its own. That August, Ken and Deb tried to broach the topic of 2109 with Lucas, in the hopes that he may have learned more about them, but soon made a troubling discovery. Every message that contained reference to 2109 was seemingly being screened, their messages often deleting off the floppy disk soon after they were sent or received. In a bid to bypass 2109's censorship, Debbie provided Lucas with a stack of paper and a bit of charcoal, hoping that he'd be able to use tools that'd be familiar to him. This took some back and forth before it worked, with Lucas guiding them to position the computer and the papers in just the right position so he could interact with them. He further claimed to have gained a better understanding of the situation, which he'd share once he was able to do so without 2109's meddling. Soon after, handwritten notes began appearing atop the computer as mysteriously as the digital messages had. Writing in period-appropriate archaic English, Lucas explained that he'd assumed the man who brought him the lemurs was God, or an angel, and that the man had told him that the lemurs would be an important part in what would be an event of incredible significance. As interesting as this was, Peter, on the other hand, was just thrilled to have some samples of Lucas's handwriting, and the fact that some hints from Lucas finally allowed them to identify the true identity of their pen pal. Just as 2109 had implied, Lucas's real name had been known all along, and was among the historical figures Peter had investigated. He was, it seemed, a man named Tomas Hardin. While this revelation was invigorating, no amount of dramatic reveals could combat the gnawing exhaustion that had begun to plague Ken and Debbie. Quote, I felt overwhelmed by the echoes of these months. They called upon me for some resolution, some answers, but I did not have any. I was sinking and began to cry uncontrollably. For his part, Tomas seemed to hear their grief, and tried providing Ken with bits of poetry he hoped would ease his pain. Adding to the emotional maelstrom was a revelation that in less than 2 months' time, Tomas would be losing his farm to the greed of a local nobleman named Grosvenor, who set his sights on Tomas's land. Soon, it seemed, the most important event in Ken's life would draw to a close, and he was nowhere close to any kind of solid understanding of what it all meant. For their part, 2109, or the Poltergeist, if they were not in fact one and the same, seemed determined to interrupt communications any way they could. The computer was often found twisted around or balanced precariously on the table ledge. In one case, the computer vanished entirely and was found undamaged in the bathroom. One such incident left the disk drive broken, forcing them to transcribe any messages they received on the computer by hand, as they could no longer save it to floppies. Just prior to this incident, Tomas had written more of the mysterious stranger who'd brought the lemurs to his cottage. The man had introduced himself merely as One. One had even visited Tomas recently, and when asked if he intended to take the lemurs away, One had merely replied that it was not his to take nor Tomas's to offer. One further claimed that while he was involved in these affairs, he had no power over them. That this thing, perhaps referencing the poltergeist, was like a child without a caring family. In subsequent communications with 2109, Ken demanded they provide a better explanation about what was going on. In the spirit of a long-suffering schoolteacher, 2109 explained that Ken was correct in linking the communications to the ongoing poltergeist phenomenon, but that beyond that, they could only tell him what he already knew. They explained that poltergeist activity is caused by surplus kinetic energy projected by one or more individuals into environments which contain a strong emotional resonance. This energy, they explained, eventually manifests as a foul entity of its own, which feeds on and hence perpetuates any strong negative emotions. When Ken pushed back, refusing to believe the poltergeist were thinking entities, 2109 responded by saying that while they were not conscious, they do adopt a sort of character or identity all their own, one which was typically formed within the subconscious of the person providing the energy. However, soon enough, lesson time came to an abrupt end when 2109 said they had good reason to believe Ken and Deb had defied their edict and gone ahead and somehow learned Tomas's true name. This led to a fiery message exchange during which 2109 admitted to doctoring several messages they'd passed back and forth with Tomas.
Color me so shocked.
Editing out information they deemed dangerous. When Ken did admit to knowing Tomas's real name, 2109 was incensed. They claimed that now there were two different Lucases running around, and if they met, it could greatly damage the time continuum.
Okay, 2109, I have to point out, you did this! You created this fucking situation, so stop lecturing, Ken! It's like you handed a child a loaded gun, and then the child shot your trophy case full of all your football medals or whatever, and then you're like, why did you do that? It's like, don't give him that. He doesn't know what it is.
If this didn't seem complicated enough, during this exchange, it was also revealed that 2109 were not the ones that gave Tomas the lemurs. In fact, they were keenly interested in the man known as One and wanted Ken to provide all the information he'd been told about this extratemporal entity who, Tomas had explained, glowed green and was rather impolite. The core takeaway being that, for all their apparent knowledge, 2109 were not the ones in control of the experiment. Perhaps trying to balance out Ken's ire, Peter took over communications with 2109. Writing with considerably fewer expletives, he asked if they operate under a paradigm which has a broader, more multidimensional view of the universe. 2109 agreed that this was an apt description of how they saw things, which allowed them to have a better understanding of temporal mechanics and time travel. For example, they explained that time travel requires an exchange. When one goes into the past, they must take the place of someone who exists at their destination, who in turn is sucked into the future. And this a full 3 years before Quantum Leap started airing.
But Doctor Who had been airing for 25 years.
Oh, that's true. Did they were doing kind of like swap like that in Doctor Who?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't know necessarily with classic Who, but
I was just thinking because he jumps into the past into someone's shoes.
Yeah, he does. They don't do that specifically, but they move around in a space-time box to the past.
Interesting.
You've seen Doctor Who.
I know. The same principle also applies to interdimensional travel, prompting me to wonder if maybe UFO abductions are really just someone getting sucked into another world so interdimensional aliens can pay us a visit. Which brings us to our fourth discussion question. So, what do we make of this idea that there are now two Lucases running around, and why would knowing Lucas was really Tomas create an extra entity? And if you can, do you have any theories as to why the two meeting would have such dire consequences?
Well, I mean, if science fiction has taught me anything, it is that you can never meet yourself in a time scenario. Why? Well, that changes from, you know, science fiction to science fiction. So, as for, like, why do I think that knowing the name would create an extra entity? I have absolutely no idea. That sounds like bullshit to me.
Yeah, it might, like, to bring up something Jay was saying last episode, this is the point where with 2109, I did kind of get the feeling of someone scrambling to answer a question they don't have an answer for because they built a pyramid of lies.
Yeah. But that being said, if it's something that is outside of space and time as we understand it, for all we know, knowing people that aren't from one dimension or timeline, knowing too much about another dimension or timeline might create doppelgangers. I don't know.
Sure.
Right. Now, as for what the two meeting have dire consequences, well, one is I imagine that the new one, the one that was created because of the knowledge, right, is essentially, I would say, probably akin to a fetch in the game Changing the Lost, which is an entity that was created by a super powerful fey-like being, and it was created because you were taken. And this being was put here in your place. And if you ever meet your fetch in Changeling, the fetch has a very strong chance of going mad. And I imagine that would be the reason why, not necessarily because Tomas would go mad. This is far from the weirdest thing that he would have experienced in the last few months. But for this baby thing that's, as far as it's concerned, only ever lived the, you know, Lucas / Tomas's life and might not know any of the information of all this weird shit, that might be a brain breaking moment. And who knows what happens when a doppelganger / fetch goes mad.
Huh.
That's a theory.
Yeah, it's a scary thought too.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I was thinking something similar, something a little similar of my the explanation that came to me here was, okay, there is a Lucas that is in the past and he physically exists as a person in the past talking to them through the Leems, and for some reason learning his real name allowed for the poltergeist that is in the present with them to assume the shape of Lucas and become a Lucas doppelganger for some reason. And if we then take the next step further of, okay, maybe the poltergeist also exists untethered from time and can be in the present house and in the past house at the same time. Why not? Yeah, maybe maybe because now it has this doppelganger face slapped over it, it's like, well, time to kill the original me and take his replacement as the head of this farm, which is going bankrupt and being bought out. Oh, damn it. Real frying pan fire situation I put myself in. That I think could vaguely be something.
Here's an idea. I'm just thinking, thinking out loud. What if it's not that it created a Lucas and Tomas in the same timeline, but rather because of the knowledge of the name, it gave the poltergeist, who, like you said, assuming that they are also outside of time, it gave the poltergeist that name, which in most magical practices, your true name is powerful, right? Which is why some people keep it to themselves and work with like a shadow name or whatever. But because the poltergeist spirit entity thing knows that name now, it effectively was able to do poltergeist magic, and it branched another timeline, essentially. It created another universe because of that knowledge, and now there's a whole nother branch out there that didn't exist prior to that because the key point being the name was not known to that entity.
Okay, so like it created a separate timeline.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Which, all right, so very similar to what you were saying, Jay, I think my primary theory was that we have the poltergeist energy that is somehow facilitating being used to facilitate communication with Tomas. Upon learning Tomas's real name, something similar like what you were saying happens. That it gave that poltergeist that character to assume. Now, thinking back on what you were saying, Rory, about doppelgangers, in most stories I've read about doppelganger appearances, manifestations, they're almost always seen as an omen of death. You see your own doppelganger soon after you die. because you're kind of seeing your own ghost before it happens. What if the concern here is, because we already know between 1 and 2109, they're both saying that this is an event of incredible importance, and Ken and Deb and Peter don't get to know why. What if the worry is that they will have given that poltergeist that persona, and that persona, if it appears to Lucas due to whatever temporal math happens, that will lead to his death. Either the poltergeist will kill him, or just seeing your other will kill you. And what if that happens in the past before the communications happen? So in a sense that him seeing his own doppelganger and dying would break the time loop. It would stop this, stop the poltergeist from ever being formed because no communication would ever happen.
So none of this ever happened.
It would create a paradox.
Yeah, it would be paradoxical, yeah. Interesting.
I mean, he's seeing Deb and Deb is seeing him. So yeah, if they create a Lucas doppelganger that's just chilling in the present with them and he occasionally sees stuff that's happening in their house, yeah, he might see his own poltergeisty doppelganger, and that could create bad things.
Oh, I mean, also, I didn't have this in the summary, but during one point, Lucas also said that poltergeist activity was happening in his cottage as well. What if the poltergeist wasn't just existing in the present?
Well, I had a thought while you guys were talking. So what if the poltergeist activity isn't really poltergeist activity? It's similar enough that is what how they're able to frame it, right? So that's how it's presented to us. But what if this is just the natural side effect of whatever the Leems is?
Maybe.
This psychic-like energy is happening around the people associated with it because it is such a powerful psychic tool, whatever it is.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, the Leems is another largely unknown thing about this. We don't know what it is. We get vague descriptions of it, and we know it glows and it has fancy symbols and it seems to move around to different parts of Lucas's house. And it seems, I mean, I get the impression it's difficult to figure out how to use it because the first guy that Lucas kind of brought in, John, probably. Yeah, and mm-hmm. he just sent nonsense messages for a little bit, like he couldn't figure out what he was doing. Like,
yeah, and you know what's something I find? So the only description we ever get of the Leems is in the postscript, where he kind of goes over, here's some extra information Lucas gave at different points that didn't make it into the narrative, which, like I was telling Rory, the first draft of this book, the current book is about a third of the size of the first draft. So a lot got cut out. But the Leems was described as a green glowing portal-like thing that when they thought words at it, they would appear on the surface and then kind of send. Mm. And what one thing, and I don't know if this is related at all, but in the cover image, we have what appears to be Lucas looking at this circular glowing thing that has symbols on it. And just that image, the image of the glowing object with the letters on it, glowing green, it made me think of the Emerald Tablet of Thoth.
Mm.
So what if the Emerald Tablet, which again, we know doesn't really exist.
Right.
But what if that was kind of a metaphor to talk about this is on how these communications with the larger universe happen? Like,
yeah.
Green is the color of those manifestations.
So I had a similar thought when they said like the glowing green and all that, except I didn't think of the Emerald Tablet. I thought of the burning bush.
Okay, interesting.
And I was thinking about it and I was like, this it feels very similar to me, especially when they were saying that the way that he interacts with the machine is via thought, you know, and then it gets projected letters on, you know, the fire, the screen, whatever. And if this is something that is so beyond his comprehension, how would he describe it? Probably like fire or like flames or like a bright light like that. So I got very serious Moses and the burning bush vibes off of it.
Which is interesting because, I mean, and we're going to talk about the character of One after this next section. But one of the points, I went all over online reading other people's theories about this story. And one that came up with shocking consistency was the argument that one is God.
I'm really upset that that is a theory that was posed online.
Because that was your theory?
That's my that's part of my theory.
He brought the burning bush, he brought the tablet. Yeah, no, I could see it.
Yeah, that's part of my theory.
I mean, the name One is kind of evocative of that.
Well, and that's why I was thinking of One, and then thinking about One in numerology and things like that. It's a powerful number. It's a number of power in the sense of it implies independence, power, hardworking, stubborn, if you're thinking about it from yourself, but also like at a deeper level, one is a number of creation. So you name yourself One because you're the first, you're the creator. Like I get that, to me, that absolutely makes sense that one is or could be potentially God, or rather what my theory is that one is the entity that has been going around gathering followers under the guise of under the name of God, and who they and who the Jewish people and the Islamic people and some Christians believe in.
Yeah, maybe. All right, so we want to move to part five before we continue our discussion about the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Part five, doubting Tomas.
Huh.
Soon the SPR guys came back, this time armed with an idea. Dave Welch wanted to initiate contact with 2109 and provide them with a list of questions, which were supposedly engineered to remove the possibility of a hoax, though we'll have to take their word on it, as the full list of questions was never revealed to Ken and Deb. The questions would be written out and then left on the screen for 40 minutes, after which Dave would go back and delete the message. Ken, Deb, and Peter would be under watch the whole time, removing the possibility that they were somehow behind the phenomenon. Though, by this point, Ken and Deb didn't have the time nor emotional bandwidth to exercise such a cunning ruse. Not long prior, Debbie had unexpectedly brought home a small black dog, whom she'd lovingly named Lucas. The dog seemed to briefly lift her spirits, but all that changed in late September. Lucas became ill, and soon after was diagnosed with parvo. Deb did everything she could, nursing him along with special food and injections, though little Lucas was obviously in great pain. There was a moment of hope when the pup seemed to come around and played for a bit, but soon after this proved to be the doggy version of terminal lucidity. Dog Lucas died in Deb's arms, and as she wailed in her misery, her cries were heard. Quote, out across time, Tomas had sensed the small dog's fight and our reactions to it, and the next day into our private world of grief arrived a beautiful and sensitive message of support. Again, leaving a charcoal message on paper, the artist formerly known as Lucas voiced his opinion that the dog is the truest friend known to man. He said that the name Lucas was a good one, and when Tomas selected it as his pseudonym, he did so to honor a man who had taken him in as a young boy. Tomas called him the wisest man he'd ever known, for whom he'd kept many secrets which he would never share with a living soul, including, apparently, Ken and Deb. As for little Lucas, Deb hung his collar on the hook under the stairs and placed his favorite squeaky toy atop the cupboard. Later, in a moment of apparent cruelty or mischief or both, the poltergeist threw the toy to the ground, prompting Deb to rush to the sound, hoping against hope that somehow her beloved friend had returned. Obviously, he hadn't. The communications continued, and soon after the loss of little Lucas, Tomas began to open up more about the mysterious Leems device and the even more mysterious entity that had given it to him. The entity One had arrived boasting of its own power. One had further warned Tomas not to communicate with 2109, claiming that they were taunters who only wished to force their thoughts on others, and that this would likely drive him insane. And perhaps sensing they were being talked about, 2109 reappeared, this time with a message that seemed to be an answer to Dave Welch's list of mystery questions. While Ken and Deb had never seen the questions, the answers were telling. 2109 confirmed Dave's suspicions that this was a tachyon universe. They further asserted that they had no form and fed off an unknown form of energy, further insinuating that they exist in some sort of alternate dimension or parallel universe. Time itself was meaningless to them. They are not from the future, they explained, because that would imply they only exist in a single moment, instead of stretched across the entire continuum of space-time. Despite their earlier promises to only answer a single set of questions, 2109 agreed to further questioning from Dave,
who at this point seemed only interested in quizzing 2109 with complex mathematical theorems, including a number which had no current solution. 2109 apologetically explained that while they could solve these, understanding the answer would require understanding other currently unknown mathematical principles. As such, they offered a trade, to give Dave an answer in exchange for some sort of service or wish. Thankfully, perhaps having read any story ever told about genies, or perhaps simply having seen the Wishmaster movies, Dave responded that he'd be happy to grant any request that did not risk the loss of anyone's souls, minds, or bodies. 2109 did not like that, and terrifyingly replied, quote, "Then let the man who is willing to lose these step forward." 2109 continued to goad Dave into accepting the bargain, but no one was biting.
Very, very fey.
Also, that's the moment I leave. Like, the moment like, fuck that. Like,
yeah. So you wanted souls. Got it.
And this is another thing that makes me feel like there's something fucky and not quite right about the whole appearance of 2109, because now we are starting to move into anytime you question me or set a boundary, I am going to shame and punish you. That feels so intensely manipulative.
Because it probably is.
I mean, 2109 is intensely manipulative.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Frustrated, John launched into his grand theory of how this could all be hoaxed. He claimed that the computer was bugged and set to save Dave's questions after they were deleted. Remember, the system had no internal memory. He further claimed that the likely culprit was at the school computer lab, ignoring the fact that by this point, Ken and Deb had shelled out for their own computer so they could stop borrowing them from the school. He further suggested that sensitive microphones could have been placed around the house to pick up the sound of keys tapping on the keyboard, from which someone could somehow reverse engineer the words that were written.
No.
It soon became obvious to everyone that the SPR wanted this to be a hoax, and had secretly hoped that Dave's questions would have gone unanswered. When faced with the inexplicable, they simply couldn't accept it.
That sound to the key, that is the biggest pile of, I have no idea how a keyboard works that I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's not like
it's fucking nonsense.
It's not like, you know, like a number keypad where each number has a different tone. Like old ones used to work. Like, that doesn't happen anymore now, but old ones, each number had a different tone, so you could kind of reverse engineer it. Keyboards don't have that.
Yeah, and especially when, and I'll talk about this, I'll talk about it later, but especially when there is a legitimate way, very complex, complicated way, that you could have potentially done this kind of thing on a BBC Micro, which is what they were using, but the OS as it is, right, like as it is just flat out, like it's, that doesn't matter. Sorry. But there's an actual explanation, very complicated, where it could have actually been some kind of hacking, but that just sounds like you made something up because you just didn't want to deal with it.
Because they probably did just make it up, because this just occurred to me just now. Why the hell didn't the SPR go to Oxford or one of the other nearby universities and go to their computer engineering department and ask for someone, like if it's just like, we will pay you for a few hours of work, just come out and look at this thing and just please explain to us if how this could be being hoaxed. Like, that seems actively negligent on their part that at no point was an actual computer expert brought in to look at this thing.
Well, I mean, very clearly. Yes.
Not just that, but also the SPR never once either themselves or sought out an expert to analyze Tomas's letters.
Yeah.
And Tomas's letters is the biggest piece of evidence. This is
physical evidence is quote unquote manifesting out of nowhere.
And it's and it's written in true Middle English.
Yeah.
Like like obviously in an audio format, we can't show the listeners, but there are pictures of some of the letters in this book, and it's Middle English doesn't look like modern English. The letters are straight up different. It's written, like, I couldn't read it just to read it. All the messages from Tomas I've read have been translated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that earlier in the book, Peter was trying to explain that to them because Peter's, you know, the linguistics expert, and they just, and the way that Ken put it is, like, they just tuned him out. They, like, weren't listening and they didn't care.
Just yeah. like with Enfield. Just like with every other case that the SPR is, that we've talked about, that the SPR has been involved in. They came into this not with an open mind or an interest in actually discovering the what was going on. They came in to Harry Houdini it and then fuck off.
Yep.
They just don't care. And as soon as they thought of a rational explanation to themselves, regardless of the evidence, they left.
Yeah.
And I do have to point out also, and this is just for the sake of fairness, that is even if they are from the SPR. Because there's some doubt True. Thrown on that later that these guys might not even be who they claim to be.
True. True. But
I mean, it kind of fits what we've seen in other books.
It fits their previous actions. So
yeah.
And like again, and I was saying this to Jay yesterday, like, I hold no ill will for the SPR of the modern day. They're probably a fine organization. But and I won't judge them based on the actions of their predecessors. That being said, I won't call them.
Yeah. Ken was understandably about done with these fools. And while they dickered about with 2109, conducting numerous experiments and receiving back messages containing either inexplicably accurate personal information or ambiguous threats, the fact remained that soon Tomas would be forced out of his home, and hence they would likely lose contact with him forever. So as the SPR obsessed over the computer, Ken and Deb kept right on communicating with their friend via paper messages, often found now on the kitchen table. They talked about their personal lives, their friends, family, and their village. They spoke about time and their shared gloom over their coming separation. The SPR, meanwhile, hit a brick wall. They had brought in a mysterious man named Nick, whom seemed to Ken to be some sort of superior. A stern and unfriendly character, he grilled witnesses to the events, and then openly suggested that this was all a hoax and could be proven as such. However, after Nick left, he never returned, which seemed to perplex 2109 most of all.
This is a hoax, and I can prove it. Walks away.
Smoke bomb!
They began writing with questions about Nick, and when the SPR refused to give them details, they vowed to cease answering any questions.
Do you think maybe Nick got, like, murdered by somebody in, like, his personal life and was, like, stuffed into a storm train?
I mean, no, I never thought this.
God, I hope not!
I just, it's like, what if he was fully intending to come back and then, like, some crazy shit happened to him that was completely unrelated to all of this? And it's just like, why didn't Nick ever come back? Oh, he fell into an irreversible coma.
I hope not.
Yeah.
He was kidnapped by pirates.
And perhaps just hoping they would resolve their beef so both parties could get the hell out of his life, Ken decided to go rogue. He wrote to 2109 telling them Nick's full name, Nick Sowerby Johnson. 2109 responded cryptically that within 48 hours, they would have a solution.
Did 2109 kill Nick?
Maybe.
Also, I'm sorry, but Sowerby sounds like when I don't know somebody's middle name, just the initial, and I just say a word when I'm trying to long name them. Nick Sowerby Johnson.
It's a very British name.
Yeah, I've definitely seen other yeah. people with that name. Though apparently never able to perform, which is common for an extra-dimensional entity of their age, this 48-hour time frame soon became stretched, with 2109 continually claiming that they were working on this nebulous solution, which may have actually involved their efforts to track down the entity known as One, as Ken discovered a file in the word processor which seemed to document a two-way communication between 2109 and One, including many taunts and odd garbled sentences. Soon after, 2109 would even suggest that perhaps the mysterious Nick was in fact the One, their apparent adversary and the true mastermind of the experiment.
Ah, fix that skin condition that made you all glowy and green. No less rude, though.
Soon after, more argumentative communication logs were found, in which One called 2109 a jack-in-the-box without a spring, unable to perform for the children. It was further implied that One had somehow taken that spring from 2109, which Ken read to mean that they had somehow interfered with their ability to interact with the past.
Nick Spring Thief Johnson.
As for Ken, he was just pleased to hear that someone was shitting in 2109's Cheerios. Meanwhile, Tomas was running out of time.
At Peter's urgings, Ken and Deb tried to coax Tomas into giving a full accounting of the events thus far from his perspective, in the hopes of disentangling Tomas's messages from any edits 2109 had made. It soon became apparent that many of the historical and linguistic mistakes made in those early messages were due to 2109's mischief. In exchange, Tomas asked that Ken and Deb make efforts to visit him again, and to be fair, Ken did try, though when he meditated in an attempt to reach out, he only saw a starry, swirling pattern before he grew frustrated and stopped. The next day, Tomas wrote to say that he was delighted to have glimpsed Ken, even if he hadn't stayed very long. Soon enough, they only had a week left with Tomas. Ken and Deb, their relationship and minds frayed by endless months of enduring the machinations of the SPR, 2109, and the One, just wanted to spend what little time they had left with their friend. Which brings us to our fifth discussion question. So, as if 2109 wasn't confusing enough, we now have the interference of the entity known as One. So what do we make of this character? What do you suspect he is, and what is his role in the drama? And why do you think he and 2109 seem to have such animosity for each other?
I will fully admit, I was lost during this part of the book. Like, the appearance of 2109, as I said in the last episode, I just kind of immediately went, oh, okay, this is something fucking with them. Heavy emphasis on the thing. I do not believe that this was a human person hoaxing them. I think this was some sort of supernatural hoax, which I will get into more in our final discussion question. And 2109 popping up just felt like confirmation of that to me. And I am very torn on the appearance of One, because in some ways it just makes me go, okay, because it feels like another thing on top of everything else, another two-ton stone in the pyramid of lies. But in some ways it also kind of makes me have some doubts of, it's like, okay, is this like honestly, you know what it makes me think of? It makes me think of the fucking Q continuum. It makes me feel like, if it's just like, okay, is One Q, like our Q, always fucking with Picard and Janeway and Sisko Q, and 2109 is the Q continuum, like right down to the weird numerical thing of like 2109, and then there's One, like, is this a group of ultra-terrestrials that actually had no interest in dealing with humanity, and then just one of them broke apart and started fucking with this guy in like the 1520s, and they were like, okay, goddammit. And they were like, well, we have to go get him. And they were just trying to, I don't know that this was, that we were, because we're only seeing, it's almost like we're seeing part of the back of a tapestry, and we can't actually reverse engineer what the entire picture on the front side is from like the one quarter panel that we've got. And so part of me feels like, okay, if I'm wrong and this isn't a hoax and this is legitimately people caught up in the machinations of the future and the past colliding into each other, it feels like a singular member of an ultra-terrestrial collective that wormed its way out of the hive mind and started abusing its powers to fuck with insects. I mean, it seemed like they were talking about the poltergeist, but they said it's like a child without a caring family of, like, you know, and again, a child pulling legs off of grasshoppers, and it's like, why are you doing that? It's like, I don't know, because I'm five and I don't understand what cruelty is yet.
Yeah.
And so the whole back and forth of suddenly 2109 can't communicate properly, and they're like, yep, One is fucking with us. Like, on one hand, it feels like lies. It feels like lies and nonsense, and like, I'm being misled. On the other hand, it feels like 2109 is stuck in a bad spot and they're trying to figure out what to do about something that is not supposed to be our problem, and the thing is making itself our problem. But for reasons we don't entirely understand, 2109 is declining to give us the full picture. So Ken and Debbie are just left spinning in the dark.
Yeah.
So I think, what do I make of the character one? I think that one is a very, it seems to be like very, the presentation of one seems to be of a being of very of great power.
Yeah.
So I think the addition of this character is very, coming in is very interesting, because if this was just a person hoaxing, it was a completely unnecessary character, a completely unnecessary lie, which makes it that much more interesting to me, because ultimately it's like, why the, like 2109 could have easily just been the one that gave the lemurs to Tomas.
Yeah.
There was no reason to have this other one brought in, it, outside of, I don't know, more.
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think that the inclusion of one is almost what tipped me over into really, truly trying to kind of accept that, like, this may have just been all actually happened. You know, this might not be a hoax or anything like that, just because of how unresolved and messy it is. When you're telling a story, you make it very neat and clean. You know, I mean, I write stories half my life. That's what you do. You know, everything you bring up in a story has a purpose. It's there for a reason. And so much of the story didn't jive with that. This seemed like a truly inexplicable mess.
Yeah. And so it's like, so what do I make of this character? Initially, I was very confused. The part that made me the most interested is how interested 2109 is in the character, in one. That made me think that ultimately what we've seen from the interactions between Lucas and Ken and Deb and all of them wasn't the point, at least to 2109. If anything, they were just having fun, or being a nuisance, or rather, I think that in their own way, what they were trying to do was be a guide of some sort. I don't think 2109 intentionally did anything that was purposefully, or I don't think they did anything that was purposefully meant to be harmful. I think they just don't understand how humans work, right?
Yeah.
That being said, I don't think they're a good guy either. I don't think one is a good guy or a bad guy. I don't think 2109 is a good guy or a bad guy. I think that they were doing what they were going to do. And I think what 2109 was actually interested in is one. And so they were there and watching all of this because they knew that one was there and watching all of this. But for some reason, one doesn't seem to be able to get involved, at least not directly outside of dropping off the lemurs. We don't see much interaction outside of that much. So as like I spoiled in the last question, who do I suspect he is? Well, as part of my the crazy theory that I was thinking of, or thinking about, I think that he is, or that it could be the entity that people see as God, or is one of those people see as God. But this one specifically, by the imagery that's used here, and this could be because of how Lucas would see it in a very Christian light, and how Ken and Deb would see some of these things, they would probably see it in a very Christian light. So the presentation was that of the Christian God in my mind. That is a direction that I'm leaning towards. But ultimately, what I think he's probably another ultra-terrestrial. I really like the idea that you brought up with the Q continuum thing and them being of the same thing, and the numbers 1 and then 2109 not being a date, but its name.
Yeah. Yeah. It is the 2109th iteration of the Ultra-Terrestrials.
And what I think is fun, interesting about that, and it actually plays into part of what I was thinking, is 2109, when broken down, is either the number 3 or the number 12. Number 12 is interesting.
Yeah.
Because 12 is a number of completion. It's a path. It's a number towards enlightenment. It is a guiding number. If you see 12, then it is something, it's meant to be that is a good thing. It's good luck. It is a guiding path. And that's very interesting to me. Because, like I said, even before you brought that up, I was seeing 2109 as not, as a bit of a trickster with what they believe is good intentions. Those intentions to us are just very, you might see them very differently. And the animosity for each other, I'm going to hold on to that.
Okay. Yeah, I do like the idea that Ken and Deb, and even Tomas to an extent, are really, they're not the point. They were just caught in the crossfire of these extra-dimensional entities. And if true, what this would be is it is the first time that at least I've come across what appears to be evidence of those entities not all operating in lockstep with each other. We've never seen a story where it seems like they're opposed to each other in any significant way. Well, yeah. Which, actually, I did have the thought of, if one is God, is 2109 demons, or the rough equivalent, maybe what inspired those stories, because, you know, the whole we want souls thing. But that said, I didn't get a very demonic feel off of 2109. 2109 just seemed like they were there for a good time.
2109 in that cosmology would feel more like angels to me, and it would feel like one is an errant Lucifer.
Oh. It's 21. Yeah. Well, especially because you almost have this kind of, you know, Lucifer. Well, you know, I'm not the first one to do this. People have connected Lucifer to like Prometheus, bringing light, fire to man, bringing knowledge of sin to man. So what if, you know, bringing the box of lights to Tomas, you have this person who's bringing knowledge you shouldn't have.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the idea of the knowledge you shouldn't have is something that I actually thought about here too, because. The idea of 2109, the immediate consequence of when the line is broken that something terrible is going to happen is very dramatic in the way that I would imagine something like an angel or an ultra-terrestrial or a demon, whatever, would be, because rules to entities like that are not rules, at least how I would understand it, are not rules how we would see them, right? Because rules to them are fabrics of the world.
Yes. Angels are, in particularly in pre-Christian lore, like in Jewish/Hebrew lore, they are beings of order, and more specifically, they are extensions of the true God. They are facets of God's will and personality that were kind of not broken off and not necessarily separated, but made into their own particular thing in order to rule over certain aspects of reality. And they existed to oppose demons. Demons were essentially the same thing, but they were beings of chaos, and angels were beings of order. And with 1 and 2109, I can absolutely see that interpretation of 1 exists to go around and give random bits of magical, semi-holy technology to random dickheads running their farm, and the angels are the ones going, "Stop!" And they're just trying to. And they just exist in opposition to each other. But mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. Rules are not an optional thing that can be bent or stepped around for angels. Of it's like, no, you are messing with the fabric of reality. By doing this, you have punched big gaping holes in the space-time continuum, and you are actively preventing me from patching those holes, and I am not privy to the information of what's going to come leaking through those holes and what's going to happen if it does.
You know, it's interesting, kind of to build on this whole idea that 2109 is, I mean, we were saying angels and demons. When I'm talking about this, I'm talking about more like Jungian, the archetype, like kind of going something more primordial than any of the human conceptions of those entities. But one thing I want to point out that might be a nod in that direction. So that up at the start of the episode, I read what are the last messages that were received from Tomas and the almost last messages from 2109. That was the reading at the start of the episode. And the message from 2109 has a couple lines in here, which were also echoed in the first line message they got. True are the nightmares of those that fear. What you fear will be a reality if you let it. Believe in yourselves. And another way of saying that is be not afraid.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is, you know, the go-to angel appearing before you statement.
Yeah, it's true. Be not afraid. I like it. That's good.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So, that was the only thing I had. I mean, the other thought I had was, what if it's reversed from what Jay was saying, and 2109 are the ones up to mischief, and one is the cop? But
I mean, I could see that. The only issue that I see with one being the cop is that he's doing a piss poor job.
Yeah, he is. And also, he was more detached from this than the others because he never sent a message to them directly. But granted, I noticed Ken never tried to message one directly.
Yes, I noticed that as well.
All right, are we ready for part six before I spoil more of Rory's big theory?
I mean, I'm pretty sure everybody's going to know where I'm going with it at this point, but yeah.
All right. Part six, a UFO dude and a bittersweet farewell. With little time left, 2109 began trying to once again communicate with Ken, Deb, and Peter. They suggested that they should take their story to the press, which Peter did. Meanwhile, 2109 offered to give them a short reprieve. They offered to freeze Tomas's time relative to their own and give them a couple months to settle their emotional turmoil and prepare to say goodbye to Tomas. They accepted, and the messages from the past abruptly stopped. Over the next couple months, they did their best to heal and to continue their research into the historical details Tomas had provided. For example, Tomas had given them a number of hand-drawn maps of his village, which, when compared to the historical record, were found to be close to accurate. Strangely, while Tomas's time was supposed to be frozen, Debbie continued to report visiting him in her dreams. During these visits, they'd sit together and share inside jokes. During one such visit, he showed her what appeared to be a fountain pen he'd carved from wood, imitating something he'd glimpsed from their time. He was perplexed when the pen didn't work as theirs did, until he was informed that pens require an internal reservoir of ink. He had previously harbored under the belief that the ink was limitless due to some sort of technological wizardry.
I mean, valid.
Yeah. Debbie also aided Tomas in preparing his house for his imminent departure, including boxing up his fowl, which seemed to have a strong negative reaction to Debbie's presence, and tending to his garden. A horse also seemed to detect Debbie and grew nervous around her, though Tomas's new cook and his visitors didn't seem to be able to see her at all. In December, the article written by Neil Barlum of the Chester Observer came out, and to Ken's surprise, it was not unkind. Though they did reach out to John Bucknell of the SPR, who, while admitting the SPR never cared to perform any sort of linguistic analysis or historical research into Tomas's letters, had soundly concluded that the whole affair was a hoax.
Ah!
Strangely, Bucknell never filed a report with the SPR and reportedly left the Society in 1986. And while the break was well received, come January, the time had come to bid farewell to Tomas, though not before one small strange side story. They unpacked the computer and sent a message to 2109, asking for another fortnight delay to prepare, which 2109 granted. During this exchange, 2109 also advised them to bring in one more researcher, a ufologist named Gary M. Rowe, who they said might be able to answer some questions about temporal communications. 2109 provided them with Gary's phone number and advised that Peter should be the one to call. It further promised to perform for Gary and write to him once he was there. They did call him, and Gary did come to the cottage to sit with them and hear their story. He looked over Tomas's letters and vowed to return with equipment to study the phenomenon. He also promised to employ other means in his investigation, though he never specified what exactly these were. Never once did he voice the same doubts the SPR investigators had, though by this point Ken was too paranoid and exhausted to care. Quote, "In Gary Rowe, I saw a sharp, intelligent man obsessed with his ideas, and these ideas, as he started to talk about his interest in UFOs, were hardly ones I could share. 2109 had warned me of this, I reasoned, but a vaguely ill-at-ease feeling remained throughout the evening. Despite 2109's promise of a continued delay, Tomas began leaving letters for them again, seemingly unaware of any time jump on his end. Tomas indicated that he had recently met a clergyman who advised that he abandon these communications as he was surely speaking with devils, though both Ken and Tomas agreed that connecting good people across the expanse of time seemed more the province of God than the Prince of Lies. As promised, Ro did come and set up undefined equipment in the kitchen, though 2109 didn't uphold their end of the bargain and no message arrived when Gary tried to reach out to them. Ken soon wrote to them voicing his disappointment, to which they replied, quote, "Hello. There are questions to be asked, and there are questions to be answered. His company powerful, but not limitless. We are. There are reasons behind motive, and motive is therefore reasonable to the man and the self. The experiment will continue without Tomas for the time being. We shall watch and react accordingly in the vertical plane. Greetings, Gary Rowe. Your move. We are here only to aid the experiment. We mean your kind no harm." They further claimed that Gary had already seen evidence of 2109's work in Canada, though Gary refused to elaborate on what they were referencing. After some back and forth, Gary decided to leave a sealed envelope atop the computer, containing a message for 2109. Soon after he left, the envelope vanished into thin air, and the next day a response came. 2109 instructed Ken and Deb to print out their reply to Gary's letter, but not to read it and not to discuss it over the phone. They met Gary at a pub, where he strangely gifted them a cassette player for their car.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, and handed him the sealed communication. Gary read the message, then silently put it back in the envelope. Quote, "He said he hadn't time to mess around. He wanted some hard information. He was, he said, making himself vulnerable by writing to them. Why, he wouldn't say." 2109 sent a few more messages for Gary, all of which were dutifully delivered unread to his hands. In response, Gary asked them to send a message back, which Ken and Deb were able to read. Quote, "I must try and answer your last letter. It would appear that you are more important than I had realized in the scheme of things." Curiously, it was noted that the syntax Gary wrote in was near identical to that used by 2109, including oddly misspelled words. Though questioning Gary on this was pointless, as he'd only smirk and respond with the haziest of vagaries. And much like the SPR, Gary never provided his final report on these affairs, and after some more conversation with 2109, vanished back into the ether from which all ufologists are formed.
I think he's a man in black.
I mean, honestly, I wanted to have a question about Gary, but I couldn't get the room.
Yeah.
This character is so fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Gary's a real person. I know this is a crazy out there thing, but like I was losing my mind at this point in the book, and I was so utterly convinced that this whole thing was a prank by mean aliens or something, and I'm like, Gary's not real! They made Gary out of tin cans and grass, and that's why he vanished! He went back to being tin cans and grass! Don't you see, Ken? There is no Gary!
I mean, here's the thing, is that Gary Rowe did write a number of UFO books.
That was the real Gary Rowe, not this motherfucker that's tin cans and grass.
That's, see, that what the Gary that they met was the other one that gets made when you learn the true name, and it's a doppelganger.
Yes. Yes.
I've gone cross-eyed.
Yep.
This whole book is being cross-eyed.
And as this affair concluded, it came time to bid goodbye to Tomas, whom by this point said he was hard at work on a book about these affairs and what he glimpsed of the future. Likewise, Ken had already decided to write his own book, if just to capture Tomas in some way and make him more than a memory lost to a distant past. On March 21st, 1986, the final messages appeared, which I read at the beginning of this episode. Tomas wrote that he was being forced to leave his home, which may be for the best, as the people of Doddleston had grown wary of him since the ordeal began. He planned to return to Oxford, where he would finish his book, swearing not to die until it was complete. He ended with a sweet request that they await him in Oxford someday, in some space outside time, where they could embrace and find love once again in each other's friendship. Shortly after, a message from 2109 arrived, containing another short poem bidding them not to fear, but to be wary of seeking knowledge that would destroy them. They advised Ken to finish his book, just as they claimed Tomas had finished his and hidden it in a secure place where it still awaited discovery. Then they thanked Ken and Deb for their cooperation, and just as mysteriously as they began, the communications across time seemed to come to a close. Though, the story doesn't quite end there.
Gary Rowe appeared again shortly afterwards, requesting they provide 2109 with a small, flattish object, which had some sort of Egyptian deity drawn on the outside, and just like the envelopes before, the object did vanish when left by the computer. And while 2109 otherwise left Ken and Deb to return to normal life, word of their antics continued to find its way back to them. In July 1987, Ken received a letter containing a printout of a message received by a Maggie and Jules Harsh Finbach, which bid them to meet Ken Webster. And they did meet him soon after, sharing their story of ongoing contact with an entity they called the Technician, who claimed that the communication with Tomas had been possible due to an overlap in time between separate dimensions. While only adding more unanswerable questions to the mix, this incident did cement their belief that this had been no hoax, as the hoaxer would now have to be flying around the world and hacking people's home computers for no other reason than to torment the young couple. Around this time, they also learned of John Bucknall's departure from the SPR, and strangely, when they asked about Dave Welch and Nick Sowerby Johnson, the SPR claimed to have no records of any investigators by those names. So, what are we to make of all this? Ken theorized that perhaps such communications are possible when two people of a sensitive nature occupy the same spot in different times, said individuals being Tomas and Debbie. Or perhaps it's a wrinkle in time, some strange but natural crack in the fabric of reality. Perhaps this even explained UFOs as sightings of some distant future momentarily glimpsed in the present. Quote, if this is so, such sightings would be restored to the natural world, as natural as snowdrops and spring showers. There might be a revolution centered around changing or recognizing different concepts of and processes within time. Out of curiosity, he tried sending this idea to 2109, who surprisingly did reply. They said that he was closer to the truth, and that most paranormal phenomena were connected, and that it involved the natural magnetic lines of the Earth and their intersections. These intersections, known as loci and geomancy, distort the, quote, light-time continuum, so much that they allow sensitive people to see across time. As for UFOs, imagine a UFO pilot flying along when he hits one such zone. He falls into a trance as his soul is squeezed into a light-time gate and forced to project a physical mirror of himself and his immediate vicinity into the past. Hence, witnesses see a craft suddenly appear and then vanish just as mysteriously. Though, for obvious reasons, Ken took everything 2109 had to say with a grain of salt, and in his opinion, this affair is likely to remain a mystery until we can one day come to a better understanding of what consciousness is and what it does. As for Ken and Deb, they did try a number of times in the following years to share their story, but found the experience to be fraught with difficulties. For example, the BBC wrote a story on the affair, but failed to interview Ken and Debbie, and further refused to publish any analysis on the letters written by Tomas, which, in Peter Trinder's opinion, are proof positive that these communications were real, as the language and syntax Tomas used were simply too authentic for anyone less than an expert academic to fake. In fact, one such expert, linguist Laura Wright, later revealed that she'd analyzed the letters and was told by the BBC to never discuss her findings with anyone else. Instead, their story focused exclusively on suggesting that Ken had faked the entire thing. Now, we may hear that and sniff the foul stench of conspiracy, but to Ken, the reason for the BBC's behavior is far simpler. The story is simply too much, too complicated, too confusing, and worst of all, it's forever unresolved. There's no catharsis, no answers, just agonizing mystery and the fractured memory of the most impactful and stressful period of their lives. The modern world, he reasons, rejects nuance and unknowns in favor of 90-second soundbites, which must, come to a definite conclusion. And the truth is that beneath the Leems, beneath 2109 and the One and the Poltergeist phenomenon, this is a story about people who found each other across time. It's a story about impossible friendship. It's a story about love. It's a story about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going. And all of that is much bigger than a soundbite. Which brings us to our sixth discussion question. And at last, we have come to the end of our story, and so it's time to ask, how much of this do you believe? Did it happen? And if so, what do you think we as readers can take from this narrative to further our understanding of the phenomenon and reality at large?
Well, first off, I just want to compliment this question. I think it's very good.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So how much of this do I believe? I think most of it, if not all of it, I believe to some extent. I think that there is a chance that some of it was because especially knowing now that the book was cut down 2/3, that it is condensed, that the timeline it seems faster than it actually was, and that it's probably been dramatized in some ways due to the nature of it being a book.
Yeah, sure.
You know, but that being said, I think that these events happened. I think that Ken can't explain them. And that's, you know, whatever. I do not think that he himself faked them. If he was bamboozled, it is without his knowledge and he'll likely never know. Because it was probably by somebody who eventually dug themselves a hole so deep that they will never let themselves get unburied if they can help it. But I don't think that's the case here. I do not think that this is a hoax. I think this is real. I think that, and what I think to get to my, I this isn't necessarily what I 100% believe, but I really like this idea. And it's that one and 2109 are effectively the archetypes of God and the devil.
You okay?
And I think, but I don't think that it necessarily started that way. I think that one and 2109, whatever they are, say they're ultra-terrestrials, say that they are extra-dimensional beings. I think that they took on a form and acted like something that these guys would understand from both sides. So the common element here was Christianity. So they took on forms like that, acted like those entities would have, so that they could do what it is that they were trying to do, which in this scenario, honestly, to me, seems like they were trying to, with the exception of the poltergeist activity, but I honestly see that as completely separate from the communications.
Almost like that, it was just the fuel that they were using?
Yeah, because when I think that whatever it was that was happening was a lot of psychic energy traversing across dimensional space, and that's going to have blowback, I would imagine. Yeah. And I think that blowback was the poltergeist activity, but I think that the entities, one in 2109, were taking on the forms of something that they would understand. One, maybe not one, 2109, yes. One, I think, is probably like an archetype or the entity that people believe to be the Judo-Christian god, because he acted like you would imagine the Judo-Christian god of the modern day would. He came in, he dropped off what he was there to do, and he left. He's hands off. 2109, if he is the archetype of Lucifer, then he was there for his own agenda, which likely was to have this human gain more knowledge, to have this human grow. Because I don't always think that the devil is in it for the bad. Because I don't necessarily even know that the devil himself understood at the time that helping persuade Eve to eat the fruit was going to cause the catastrophe that it caused. I don't know that he knew that. I'm not sure that it would have mattered. But I don't know. I don't know that he knew that. But one thing to kind of build on this that I noticed is the earliest communications from like Ken and them to 2109 were very it was more akin to the messages from 2109 to Gary. They were very direct, but as time went on, they started to form a personality. And that personality eventually became something that I would say was a bit of a trickster.
Yeah.
A bit of a mystery being that was trying to guide them down a path. Whether or not that path is good or bad is irrelevant. Was trying to point them in a direction. And that direction ultimately came down to understanding the fabric of the universe, because that's what they kept hinting at every time. I can't tell you this because you wouldn't understand yet. you know, I can't do this, or you're on the right path to understanding the, you know, this thing because of your theory, whatever it is, confirmation, yeah. but never any additional guidance onto it. And I could see that as something that Lucifer would have done to help guide them towards essentially the fruit. And again, the Lemes was, it has a lot of imagery to me that says very much like the burning bush. So if that's the case, and God, you know, God one left it there for communications purposes, and Lucas may not have been the target for that from one initially, you know, whatever it is, we don't know because one didn't really get involved. So all of this could have been happening with one sitting there going, well, eventually I'll actually talk to the person I want to talk to. Until then, you make your own choices, free will.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and so when, and I mean, I'm when you're saying like the archetypes, they, it's not so much that it is the biblical devil.
Correct.
It's this entity, because it's being filtered through Ken and Tomas's Christian upbringing, is taking on characteristics that are in line with their belief.
Exactly. Exactly. And then eventually, and then creating a scenario that's going to help them get to wherever, to get to the same conclusion, right? Because I also got a lot of very, a lot of Job vibes here. Because look at, and like, not to the same extremes, like Job was an was very extreme, but the entire time that they're going through this, Ken repeatedly talks about how much this was the hardest time of his life, the most stressful moments of his life. Like, he talked about in the early parts of the book, talked about being a musician, and then that shit's fucking forgotten later on. Like, and same with Deb, talking about her aspirations and goals, and that shit's gone until later on, because all of a sudden they're in this horrid trial that they're going through. Very Job-like to me, you know, and even if they weren't very devout in it, if that's their framework of understanding, these entities are going to pick up on that and start, I feel like they're going to then start trying to frame this in that light so that they can understand it. So yeah, that's essentially what I mean. That's essentially what I, my crazy theory is that these entities, whatever they are, took on these archetypes because that was going to help them get to whatever it is that they, whatever message, whatever experiment they're trying to perform. And I think that, like with 2109 to Gary, I think that was completely separate. Honest to God, I think that at this point he realized that 2109 realized this was all coming to an end, so he was just trying to keep his own narrative moving.
Like, listen, we need you to listen. We're done with you. We just need you to help get our next chapter started with Gary over here.
Everything's got to, you know, point A to point B.
So, as I've said a few times in this episode and in the previous episode, I think this was a hoax that was being played on them by a supernatural entity. And what I think that supernatural entity is I think Debbie was stuck in a shitty relationship and made a poltergeist. I think Thomas was another fraction of that poltergeist. I think he was the main facet of the poltergeist, because the bits with her and Lucas / Thomas, it's like this is a romance novel. It's like it's this hard working man from the 1500s, and he seems like a bit of a brute and a bully to his housekeeper, but he's always kind and gentle to you, and he's madly in love with you and writes you poems, but he doesn't expect anything from you, and he's not trying to break up your relationship, which seems fraught with a lot of tension all the time, because neither one of you is actually happy. And it seems like, to me, that 2109 and 1 were additional facets that were being created by this same entity, by this same poltergeist, to keep the ruse up. Like, honestly, I am not saying, I need to establish this right off the bat, I am not saying Debbie has DID. I am pulling from some of the ways that I understand that fully blown cases of dissociative identity disorder can work, this feels parallel to additional alters being created to clean up messes made by older alters. This, and like I said in the last episode, it feels like 2109 was created, it feels like it was inserted into this larger lie to serve as an explanation for things that weren't making sense. And then when things about 2109 stopped making sense and stopped being an adequate explanation for other things that were happening, all of a sudden one pops up, and now one can serve as the explanation for anything that doesn't make sense about 2109, just like 2109 was functioning as the explanation for anything that wasn't making sense with Lucas. And even the brief period of time where it seems like Lucas was gone, and again, like I said at an earlier point, of this almost feels like an abusive dynamic where when the person asks too many questions or tries to set too many boundaries, they're punished and shamed and persuaded to not try to do that again. The whole thing of, well, you're asking too many questions about Lucas, so say bye-bye to Lucas. You don't get Lucas anymore until I decide he can come back.
I'm curious. I mean, I think it's a very interesting idea. I'm curious, under that framework, what do you make of the apparent authenticity of Lucas's language?
Like you said, traumatic wonder kinds. And also something that occurred to me while we were taping last episode, reincarnation. If reincarnation is a facet of this, it's entirely possible that the reason that Debbie's subconscious could perfectly recreate that syntax is because in an earlier incarnation, that was her language, that was her syntax, and she's just pulling it from back then. And a lot of the historical accuracies, it's possible that Thomas was a real man at one point. One thing that I kind of floated to myself at one point when I was working on this theory of, it's like, is Debbie Catherine?
Actually, I was just thinking about that. What if Kath, because there was this period in the book, which I don't go into, where one of Debbie's earliest visions of Lucas saw Debbie and Catherine was in the room, and he tried to get Catherine to see Debbie. And when she couldn't, Lucas flew into a rage because he thought that Debbie was trying to make him look crazy or something. And he started yelling at Catherine, and Debbie took that. That seemed to hurt Debbie quite a bit. And what if she was feeling what she had felt when she was Catherine?
I think it's entirely possible that Debbie was pulling from memories of past lives, that at one point she was Catherine. She may have had feelings for her boss, Lucas. And when she was, because like you said, baby, this was the crappiest time in her and Ken's lives. Their relationship was in a bad state at this point. And especially with the fact that she was seeing Lucas in her dream specifically, which is when most people with past life experiences have those visions of their previous incarnations, she might have just been lonely and feeling emotionally neglected and all of this stuff. And she may have just been pulling from an earlier stage of her existence while she was trying to process and cope with these feelings that may have fueled the poltergeist activity that was already present in the house. And when I say I feel like this was a supernatural hoax, I agree with the assertion from 2109, which is interesting that 2109 are the ones that brought that up. Poltergeists are absolutely capable of thinking. They are absolutely capable of deception. I think this may have been an exceptionally clever poltergeist that decided to take a new tactic with its pranks and was like, I'm going to catfish the lady of the house. I'm going to make her fall in love with me. And you know that Jennifer Lawrence movie, No Hard Feelings? It feels like at one point the poltergeist was like, I'm in too deep. I'm going to shatter this woman. I have to keep making up new lies. And it's just something towards the end of the book of, it's like, this feels like a remorseful catfisher that's just like, I got to ease the blow. I can't. Oh God, it turns out these people are really nice and they're just going through a shitty time. I've got to rethink my whole strategy about how I interact with reality. That's what it felt like to me, at least, is this feels like a supernaturally powered hoax that was feeding off of the complicated, messy emotions that Ken and Debbie were going through, and it just went way too far, and it got way more complicated than even the entity originally intended it to get. And right down to, you know, we talked about poltergeists tend to be a short-term thing. This activity petered out over a few years and didn't really resume much beyond, like, you know, that, like, that couple being like, hey, we got a message asking for you while we're having poltergeist activity. This wasn't a thing that plagued them for decades and has followed them through every stage of their life. They were going through a crappy time. They didn't feel safe with or supported by each other. They both had to give up on a lot of dreams and kind of rework how their whole future was going to look. And then it's me, your best friend, Thomas, just kind of pops up. And then as things settle down, Ken starts getting a new job. He and Debbie get a little bit better at communicating with each other without things completely spiraling out of control. And then just all of these communiques from outside of their time just kind of trail off, almost like they don't need that vent anymore.
Quite possibly.
I could see.
Yeah.
No, I like both of those theories. I think that this happened. And I think the reason that I say that is, like I was saying earlier, it's too messy in a sense. Like, if I was going to take a series of lies I'd concocted and put it in a book, you have catharsis. You have the Union Screaming House book we read.
Yeah.
Everything lines up. Everything follows a consistent internal logic. And it's all wrapped up with a neat bow by the end. And that is very much not what we got here. I Ken's angst over this felt very real to me.
Yeah.
And even like his preface in the second edition, you could tell this still bugs him as of 2021. And that it felt very real to me. In terms of like grand theories, I don't know. I certainly like your guys' ideas. I do tend towards thinking that this was involving some sort of outside entity, but that said, I come back to the question of, is if we're saying, all right, it's a poltergeist generated by an individual, it's an outside entity, are we necessarily talking about a different thing? Especially if you look at it like an idealist philosophy, thoughts are things, they're entities. What is the difference between an extra-dimensional entity and an extra-dimensional entity if both are thoughts, if everything is thought?
Well, whose thought?
I guess that'd be the question. Whose thought is it?
Because a poltergeist, based upon our framework, I suppose, and using that terminology, is it's centered to one person, typically speaking.
Yeah.
So then this would be, like, if it's a poltergeist, then it's centered around Deb, in theory. That seems to be the primary target here. If it's not, then who?
I think the only thing that I question when regards to it's all a poltergeist is, then I've never heard of a poltergeist then going and attaching to someone else and continuing communications elsewhere.
That's the part that I got confused about in terms of the poltergeist. That being said, if it is a poltergeist, the communication, all of the interactions could have been the poltergeist, but the entity that they talked to may not have been.
Like we were saying earlier, like, yes, there's a poltergeist, but there's something using that poltergeist, that energy, right, as an opportunity to do what it was doing.
Right.
Also, did they get that message from the other couple after their story had been publicized a couple of times?
That's true. They did. Yeah, so that's entirely possible.
It's entirely possible that their poltergeist, kind of like, I mean, the Enfield poltergeist was copycatting other poltergeists in its area. It's possible that this one just sort of vaguely was aware of Ken and Debbie and mm-hmm. was like, yep, let's just throw that into the pile because poltergeists exist to confuse us. It is one of their favorite things to do.
Well, and if everything is a thought and then it goes into this thought bank that is the, you know, what did you call it?
Akashic record.
That one. Then that poltergeist being a creation outside of us likely has access to that and is going to use it. It could use it as framework.
Absolutely.
And maybe they had a subtle reason to want to have those two couples interact.
They were hoping they'd wife swap.
I mean, that's certainly a direction.
So they could peeve on it through the mirrors.
Okay, here's the other thing. You know how I brought up that I could see parallels to conditions like DID in this? Poltergeists ultimately are an expression of there's unresolved emotional grossness happening here. It's entirely possible that the reaching out to Ken was on some level a manifestation of whoever that activity was centered around, desperately crying out for help, mm-hmm. and the poltergeist latching on to the one name it vaguely knew from recent history of, hey, these people went through this. Maybe they can help you make me stop existing. Because, I mean, they might not like existing, poltergeists. If they're just a manifestation of our emotional ickiness, their entire existence could be pain.
Yeah, that's true. I will say I didn't answer the last bit of your question here. And what do we think the readers can take from the narrative to further our understanding of the phenomena and reality at large? Shit cray.
I like that. Shit cray cray.
Yeah, like, I mean, truthfully, like, I think you summed it up here in the last sentence or two of your summary really well. It's saying it's a story about love, it's a story about who we are, where we've been, and where we're going, and all of that is much bigger, and all of that is much bigger than a soundbite. And I would just change that last bit to saying all of that is much bigger than us.
Yeah, it's bigger than something. I mean, that could be the big takeaway, is that you have to accept a certain level of mystery that will not be resolved in these topics.
Yes, 100%. Do not expect catharsis.
Yeah.
Ever.
Because that's not the point.
No. I think, and either we've talked about this before, and I think that the thematics of that have come together accidentally in our show is a really good example of that, like with being the Midnight Roads. I think the goal, I think the point is the journey. And I think that this is a really good example of that because it was a path that has changed them. It was an event in their life that changed them and ultimately very likely made them better people on the other side.
Yeah, I could see. I think that's a good note to end on. Do we want to go into the About the Author?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so prepare for what is simultaneously the longest and shortest About the Author in our show's history.
Which is a weird statement.
Ken Webster was born in the Lake District in 1955. He is a graduate of UCW Amberswith in 1976. He currently lives near Chester. His main interests are contemporary music and classic Jaguar cars. He did not choose to become involved in parapsychology. And that's it. No, really, that's it. A short little blurb in the back of the book. Listeners of our show should know by now that we'd love to talk to the authors of the books we cover, and this one was no exception. So, determined to learn more about the mysterious Ken Webster, and hopefully book him for an interview, I got on my typing gloves, dusted the potato chip dust from my beard, and set to work trying to track him down. I'm not always successful in these searches, and often I find the trail ends in a cold grave or an unresponsive email address.
Jacques Vallée.
But in this case, I found something else. A mystery that swallowed me entirely and led me on a wild goose chase which ended, I'm sad to say, with a whimpering anticlimax. I began my search as I usually do, via Google, and like many authors we have interviewed, it quickly became apparent that Ken's contact information isn't available on the public internet. I also checked through numerous sites via the Wayback Machine, but the only reference to a Ken Webster I could find is an economist. And while I wondered if they may be one and the same, the details don't line up with how Ken presented his life and career in the book. So I began reaching out to other sources. First, I contacted Dr. Melvin Willen, who you may remember is the chief archivist for the SPR. I assumed that, given the SPR involvement in the case, he might have something in his records. Did a search of the SPR archive and came back with nothing. Not even the slightest mention of any authorized or unauthorized investigation at Doddleston. He also ran a check on the names of the SPR investigators who are named in the book and could find no record of them. He did admit that sometimes investigators would simply not file reports, but that wouldn't explain why the men didn't show up in the SPR rosters from the time. Of course, Ken may have used fake names, in which case this endeavor was doomed before it began. Dr. Willen then directed me to the Ghost Club and another UK-based paranormal investigation group, which would have been active in the 1980s, but neither of them had any record of the investigation. Next, I went the legal route, checking on death certificates, property records, and the like. I did manage to track down the address of the Meadow Cottage, but the only record of sale in the database was in 2002. My assumption is that anything older is likely stashed away in some dusty records bin in Doddleston. Next, I checked out the publisher of the second edition of the book, Iris Publishing. There was an email listed in the legal text which I did send a message to with no reply, so I tried to dig into the company to find that it likely doesn't exist. I did find Iris Publishers, but the logo is wrong and a vertical plane is not among their catalog. Likewise, I found Iris Press, but the logo is off and this one focuses exclusively on publishing academic works. I then noticed that the book was printed on demand via Ingram Spark, a print-on-demand service often used for self-published books, leading me to suspect that Iris Publishing either doesn't exist or was created just to publish the second edition. As a final attempt, I then tried to track down either Deb or Peter, but found them both to be just as elusive, though I did manage to find a little more evidence that Deb was an actual person and a single old interview with Peter. So where does that leave us? Thus far, I have found no digital record which indicates Ken Webster exists, at least not by that name. I wondered if he may have used fake names, but could he have ensured those same fake names would be used in the newspaper articles and television programs released about their story? So does this mean the story was made up? Not at all, merely that Ken may have taken steps to protect himself from discovery. And if the story in this book is 100% factual, then I could understand why, as it seemed that even the SPR couldn't help but ridicule him. Now by this point, I had been chasing Ken for weeks, and I felt it was time to let the mystery rest. But I did make the obligatory Hail Mary pass, and posted the story of my search to that great digital hive mind of unregulated insanity, Reddit. And much to my shock, this may have brought me closer to Ken and Deb than I'd ever been before. Soon after I posted my desperate bid for information, a user responded, someone who had also pursued this mystery and had even spoken with Deb on a number of occasions. Here is their message. Quote, "The only thing I can contribute to your search is that Ken and Debbie are real and Ken does not want to be found. I've gone down this rabbit hole. Ken and Deb did some interviews when the book initially came out. They were in newspapers and on TV. At the time, they were thoroughly vetted. They had published the book in hopes that if the story was out there, that perhaps other people had a similar experience or could help solve the mystery. Instead, they were pretty publicly ridiculed and accused of hoaxing it. At this point, Ken went to great lengths to not be findable. When he feels up to make a statement, he finds you and uses a burner email. And frankly, I don't blame him. This sort of topic can have a very negative effect on your work and social life, and when you genuinely believe it happened to you, a detrimental effect on your mental health when people accuse you of making it up. I have found and exchanged ideas with Debbie. She is very much like Ken in trying to stay out of the public eye, but not as elusive. I've asked her and have made an argument for her doing some interviews, but she is on the fence. Perhaps in time she may come around, but I think if she is pushed, she may disappear again. She is a nice lady that really wants to know what happened to them at the cottage. She interacts with a small group of researchers and investigators online, but unless she says otherwise, I'm respecting her privacy and not telling people how to find her or Ken. It can be done, but I'm pretty sure they don't want to be found. For now, it may be best to move on with your podcast without them or put it on the back burner till she's ready. The only person left that has also been vetted and met the SPR guys is Gary Rowe. He is a famous UFO investigator that in recent times has become just as hard to find. Gary has said that his interactions with 2109 convinced him to keep what happened a secret. This is not necessarily nefarious or indicative of a hoax. I think he believes that he will one day be able to use what he knows to prove it was real. Unfortunately, in the meantime, he isn't talking. Everything was at some point vetted in the pre-internet days. A lot of it was verbal confirmation or paper records that are now lost to time. This seemed to be the nature of any paranormal case I've looked into or been actively involved with. Take it for what you will, but the paranormal doesn't want to be solved. It's filled with strange coincidences, deaths, and evidence that becomes harder to re-verify the further out you get from the event. Stuff happens to the people involved that makes them want to disappear or not comment on it. End quote. Which is where our mystery within a mystery draws to a close. Is Ken real? Did any of the events detailed in this book happen? Was I bamboozled by a Reddit user with too much time on their hands? We may never know. And if what I found is true, that is exactly how Ken and Deb want it to be. So I intend to respect that wish and leave the topic here. Though, if you asked me what I'd like to believe, it's that something odd happened in Doddleston. Something remarkable, and not just that there were poltergeists stacking tins or mysterious messages from a disembodied demigod. What happened was people found each other. Over centuries, they forged a bond. They made a friendship, and through an impossible medium, accomplished that most human of goals. They found love in each other. And if nothing else, I'd like to believe that.
Very well said.
And that brings us to the end of The Vertical Plane.
Yes, and what a book it was.
This book consumed me for a bit. I felt like I was about a hair's breadth away from creating the crazy conspiracy chart of putting paper on my wall and connecting it with yarns.
Ah, you were going to Charlie Day it, huh?
I've connected two things. You've connected shit. I've connected two things.
So with that, are we ready for our housekeeping then?
I suppose so. Housekeeping.
Housekeeping.
So if you liked what you heard, please like and subscribe on whatever podcasting platform it is that you are listening to us on. And if it is Apple or Spotify, please leave us a review. 5 stars. Preferred, but not required. And if you want to reach out to us, you can do that. Noctivigantpodcast@gmail.com. Feel free to leave us any feedback, any comments, concerns, things that we got wrong, anything at all. You can do that. Or you can reach out to us on social media. On Twitter, @NoctivigantPod, and I am @MixRoyWicks.
I am @BearishTerror.
I am @MidwestUndead.
And then we have a plethora of other social media and a Discord channel. Link will be in the description. You can join our Discord for weird discussions. And then we also have Instagram, @Noctivigant_podcast.
We have a Reddit account, Noctivigant Podcast.
We have a Tumblr account, Noctivigant Podcast.
And I think that's it.
Yeah, so stay tuned for next week for our edition of Midnight Chats, whose guest is a surprise.
Yes.
And also stay tuned next month as we are going to launch into Northern Lights, High Strangeness in Sweden by Fred Anderson, which Rory is going to be leading us through.
Yes, I am.
But you're going to hear from us before that.
Yeah, for sure. And if we are going to do a live stream, keep an eye on our Twitter account, our Instagram, and all of the socials, as we will post the dates and stuff there, as well as in the Discord channel. But I think that's it. Is there anything else? Did we forget anything?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
All right.
I'm sweaty. I'm ready to move.
All right, then lead us out of here.
All right. Good night, ghosties. Good night, ghoulies. Good night, moth people. Stay safe on those midnight roads.
Don't get lost.
Seriously, don't.
God, you two are no fun.
No, the weather out there is so bad right now. Don't get lost.
Run off into the dark.
You have no shelter.
Follow the whistling you hear in the woods.
It's so cold.
It's very cold. And there are hungry foxes and bears out.
I mean, you would have to worry about hungry foxes. Not me. You're very small.
If they were in great enough numbers, you would absolutely have to worry about hungry foxes.
I mean, sure. But I feel like we're about to get into a whole, like, horse-sized duck.
We're done.
Yeah.
The collective noun for foxes is charm. A charm of foxes.
Cute.
Thank you.
Yeah.
God, how disappointing would it be if we invented time travel one day and it turns out one was just some dude who wanted to fuck around?